Let me repeat the whole talk. Okay. All right, thank you. So in these tensor models, we're interested in examining various phases of the theory. One such phase is the large N. And of course, in a statistical theory, we're interested in various universality properties. So I'm going to talk about how we can get to that directly through the Schwinger-Dyson equations. Okay. And then I'm going to, well, not talk about how you can use these Schwinger-Dyson equations to basically solve for the Green's functions order by order in the 1 on N expansion. But I will use some of the results that you can glean from this analysis in the description I'll give of the double scaling limit that was derived recently in tensor models. And then afterwards, I'll finish with one slide on how one can use these Schwinger-Dyson equations to actually generate for you the underlying symmetry algebra of your tensor model. And this also captures quite a lot of the characteristics of and the physics of your model. Okay. So I think at this stage, I hope we're relatively familiar with the idea that in tensor models, we're interested in evaluating things with respect to by integrating them with respect to the components of the tensor and weighted by some function of the tensor and its complex conjugate. Okay. So a random tensor here for me is a large collection of complex numbers that are arranged into a multidimensional array. So this array has d indices, and each index can take n values. Okay. So then to tame the this object a bit, what you do is you impose that the theory should have a certain symmetry. So you impose that the tensor should transform under a certain unitary covariance where there is a distinct unitary transformation for each of the indices. And once you have that, then it's natural to motivate that the objects that you'll be interested in are the so-called tensor invariants. So these are bunches of T's and T bars that are contracted along their indices, subject to certain admissibility conditions. So obviously, because it's unitary transformation, a T must be contracted with a T bar. And also, because there are distinct unitaries on each index, you know that there is no index mixing. So an index in the position one must be contracted with an index in position one. Okay. And then once you have these invariants, this set of invariants, you can think about forming actions that can be used to weight your probability measure. So the type of actions we're interested in are the ones where you at least have this unique quadratic invariant, which I'll explain in a second, and you have some finite set of the other invariants. And these are the coupling constants of the theory. Well, z and t of I are, and v is the number of vertices, or the number of, excuse me, I got there too quickly, the number of fields t in the melon, in the bubble, in the tensor invariant. And there's so many words for these things. So then we'll be looking at analyzing these objects. So, and of course, we'll want to extract information from them. So the natural way then, once you have a probability measure, is to extract the, calculate the observables. So the obvious observables are the partition function here and the moments. So there should be a 1 on z here, a normalization factor. And Razvan has shown that the natural moments are of this type of measure are indeed these tensor invariants themselves. So that's hopefully seeable. Okay. So the nice thing about these tensor invariants is that they're cataloged by decolored graphs. So a decolored graph are built in the following way. So for every tensor T that I have, I replace it by a black vertex with D indices, with D edges coming out of it. And for every T bar, I have a white vertex with D edges coming out of it. And because there's no index mixing, I know that each edge has a prescribed color. And if the unique quadratic invariant with T and T bar fully contracted will be represented as two vertices with all their lines mutually joined. Okay, but I can construct more. So here's a quartic invariant where I would have two tensors T and two tensors T bar. And the way the lines are joined maps the contraction of the indices in the invariant. And here's a more generic example in 4D. Okay. So to make a shortstop in quantum gravity. So we are interested, obviously, in these theories in making contact with quantum gravity, and we do that via the perturbative expansion. So we examine, let's say, for example, the partition function here, and what we do is we expand the vertex of the interaction operators in the in this object. And after Taylor expanding, we do a Wick's theorem. So we know, morally speaking, that this should be that the Feynman diagrams generated by this expansion should be vertices joined by propagators. Now, these propagator lines I've put in dashed here, and the vertices, of course, we know themselves, that they themselves are in fact decolored graphs, and that the decolored graphs, the vertices of these decolored graphs represent the tensors T and T bar. So when I do a Wick contraction, obviously I contract a T with a T bar, and that gives me the propagator line joining these things. And from these decolored graphs, I generate that, and propagator lines, I generate D plus one colored graphs. So what's very nice then is that you can show that these graphs, this class of graphs, encode for you in a graphical way a D-dimensional topology. So I can reconstruct vertices, edges, faces, three cells, and so forth, up to the D cells. So in particular, I can reconstruct the faces. So the second part of this expansion, of course, is what are these graphs weighted by? What are the amplitudes? And up to a combinatorial factor, of course, they're going to be weighted by some function of the parameter n, the size of the tensor, and the Comte constants. So and here, these extra exponents here, these are functions of the number of vertices in the graph. And here again, we have the number of faces in the graph of a certain type. Okay. So to make a more direct contact with quantum gravity, what one does is one maps these objects to the space of dynamical triangulation. So is there some? Right. So for every vertex I have in my D plus one colored graph, so let me do a four colored graph, let us say, that gets 0, 1, 2, 3. This gets mapped to some simplex in three dimensions, let's say. So in for four color graphs, I can reconstruct three-dimensional simplices. And the graphs here, the D-dimensional topology encoded by these graphs here are, in fact, through this dual mapping, are, in fact, triangulations, so simplicial manifolds. Okay. So what you do then is that you say, well, I can map the space of D-dimensional topologies here. I can identify them as triangulations in D dimensions by this dual mapping. And then I can identify them as equilateral triangulations by introducing a parameter A. And in that sense, I have the beginning of their mapping to dynamical triangulations. No. So for these, there's enough constraints on these objects that they at least form D-dimensional pseudo-manifolds.
Yeah, pseudo-manifolds.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. So yeah, that's quite right.
But that's five.
Yeah, but we still. I've died here. Okay. I spent too much. There you go. So yeah, I don't know. That is my name on my computer, just to remind myself that it's pseudo manifold. So I have so yes, it's d-dimensional simplicial pseudo manifolds that they're mapped to, and indeed they're wild. But we can put the idea behind the tensor model, of course, is that you can exert some control on these objects, and quite a lot of control. So the next thing in the mapping to dynamical triangulations is to map the parameters to the parameters of dynamical of gravity. And so in a loose way, or very vaguely, they say that the map is that the N and the Z get mapped to the bare Newton and cosmological constants, while these other coupling constants, T, are tunable to attain multi-critical behaviors, as we'll see. And they have been identified by Valentin as being linked to statistical matter on random geometries. Okay. So now I have to do a small amount of drawing. So when we're dealing with the Schwinger-Dyson equations, I'm gradually going to bring this over here. We're going to be interested in not just diagrammatically representing invariant objects, but also covariant objects, and then doing some surgery on them. So for example, let me take the easy way out and say that this is some decolored graph, right, B. And so this the contractions in this graph represent some polynomial in the tensor, some monomial in the tensor field, in the tensors, right? So when we're looking at the Schwinger-Dyson equations, what we're going to do is we're going to have to act with derivatives on the polynomial. So what it means then is that, let's say I act with a derivative with respect to t bar on the polynomial. That's going to remove a t bar, obviously, from the polynomial. And given that t bar is represented by some vertex in the polynomial v bar, let's say, what it's going to do then is it's going to cut that vertex out. And so the object b less v bar is the graph b where I've cut out the vertex b. So that has now d open edges. And then I may well act with a derivative. So I'll be interested in acting then with a derivative with respect to t. So that so t then is represented in this graph by some vertex v, right? So I have some vertex v that is connected in this graph, and I cut that out when I'm doing it graphically. So now I have an object v, b less v bar less v. Okay, that'd be one. And then I'm looking, so it will have 2D indices, and then I'm looking to contract these indices again, so to get a new bubble. So the contraction of the indices is then indicated by rejoining these lines. Okay, so by applying derivatives to my tensor invariant, it is equivalent to performing surgery on the graph. So by cutting out two vertices and then contraction of the tensor indices refers to contraction of the indices again. Okay. So the second type of surgery that one would be interested in is to consider then two bubbles. B.
So may I ask, is there a topology preserving?
No. No. Yeah, okay. No. Not necessarily, no. Not at all. So I have two invariants, B, and oh, I'm going to have to type in sudo again. Right, and I cut out one field v from one invariant, and I cut out a v bar from this invariant, and then I contract the indices again. So at the end of the day, I'm going to glue these indices together, and it's going to represent something like this. So v. And that's going to be represented in the diagrams by B less B bar. Okay. So the idea of, yes, so to reiterate, the idea of this graphical surgery is the removal of tensors and their complex conjugates from the monomials, from the tensor invariants. And that gives you something that's covariant. And then gluing these things back again gives you something, a new bubble that's a new tensor invariant. I really should have set my set out time. No, no, it's not. It's close, but it's not. I'd tell you, but you know, I'd have to kill you. Okay, so here's a specific example. for the quadratic invariant. So in the quadratic invariant, let's say it's just, this is the invariant I start off with. Then I remove the t bar by acting with the derivative, and I get down to essentially, obviously, the t, which is represented just by the graph with one black vertex. And then I act with the derivative with respect to t bar. So that will remove the black vertex, but leave these lines, essentially just Kronecker deltas. And then I contract again, so to do the contraction operation, and I just get d loops. And so I just get a factor of n to the d. The surgery two, then, that I'll, in an explicit example, is that I take some bubble b, so anyone, and I remove one t bar. That means I remove a vertex v bar from the graph, and so I have d open n. Then I take the graph b2, let's say here, and I remove the black vertex. Right? So I am left with the white vertex, just the v bar. And then I glue again. And of course, this white vertex just replaces the one that I removed from b originally. So I get back to b. OK, so that's two types of operation. OK, so here's the generic definition of the Schwinger-Dyson equation. So and it's, you know, this is perhaps the most direct way to get there. So I have a zero on the left-hand side because essentially I integrate a total derivative. And then I'm going to evaluate, integrate this quantity inside the in the bracket. So this is a tensor invariant with one vertex removed, and this is the usual weight. So when the derivative with respect to t acts on the b less b bar, what it's going to do is it's going to remove a v, right? So that's, it's going to remove a t. So in the graph, it's going to remove a v. And because the indices are contracted, I get back to the invariant, so to an invariant quantity, which I can evaluate. When it acts, then it, the t acts on the action. So first it will act on the quadratic term, and it will kill the t and bring down a t bar. And that t bar will just replace the one that was removed from this object. So adding it back, it gets the b. And then the derivative will act on the invariants that are in the interactions. So it will remove a t from one of these interactions. So that's equivalent to removing a b. But then because these indices are contracted again, it will contract it with this object that I had downstairs. And so I get this new invariant again that I drew on the board on the right-hand side. OK. Oh, come on now. Is it like 2 seconds that my It's a projector, right? Oh, it's it, power out. I went on. I think that's fate, right? I mean, somebody's telling me something.
I'll reboot the projector for you.
Yeah. How am I doing? What time is it? I'm almost at 10. 10 minutes, right. So, right, okay. I have a bit of work to do to get to the end. But, well, yeah, but not too much. Yeah, but I can't say. Yeah, but. Okay, I actually don't know how to. Is it back up? No, I need to. No, I need to leave it off for a second. It's not a. All right. I don't think so. Yeah, I'm not sure. Is it on? Or? Oh, and here it comes on now. Okay. Yeah. Okay. No. Hey, so it really should be on now? Okay. Oh, thank you. That was controversial. All right, so I start again, and okay. So one particular example that one might be interested in looking at of these Schwinger-Dyson equations then is to take B to be the quadratic invariant. So I calculated these on a previous slide. So when I remove two vertices from B2, then I get basically n to the d. Here, and the expectation of n to the d is just n to the d, so I get a 1. Two, substituting in here, of course, just gives me this, and then 2 performed in the surgery up here, then as before, it just gives you back the bubble at b, or the invariant bi at the that you had at the beginning. Okay. So now one can look at the large n expansion. So there, with the Schwinger-Dyson equations, you always have to give some input. And the input that you usually have to give has to do with the scaling of the observables. So the first part of the scaling information is that at large n, the observables factorize. So that is that the expectation of the product is the product of the expectation. And this is a generic thing for generic fact for any theory where, in the scaling in n, the faces contribute positively. So it's true for matrix models. It's true for tensor models. The second is that you actually have to identify, you have to give the Schwinger-Dyson equations as an input, what are the relevant observables in the scaling limit that you're interested in. So here we are, that one finds by another analysis that the relevant observables for tensor models are these invariants B that are Melonic. So a Melonic invariant is in the class are constructed iteratively. So the simplest Melonic invariant is the quadratic invariant. And one generates more complicated Melonic invariants by removing, let us say, an edge of color C and inserting this subgraph in its place and doing that iteratively. And that will generate for you the class of Melonic graphs. Okay. So the argument then is that these two inputs that you give, Melonic dominance and factorization, tell you that only a subset of the equation of the Schwinger-Dyson equations are relevant in the large n limit. And they're of this part. So the first two terms are essentially unchanged, but they must be the only observables occurring are those that are Melonic. And the real information that this Melonic dominance and factorization give you is that the first term, where you have performed this surgery, where you've removed two vertices from the same bubble, it's essentially equivalent to taking this Melonic graph that you had at the outset and removing a melon. So by removing a melon, I mean exactly the inverse process of this. So instead, I take this kind of structure that's in my Melonic graph and I kill it. Okay, and that's the graph that it gives me. Okay, so in some sense, you could call this as an equation that relates the bubble B with its relative with one melon removed, or annihilated. Okay. So then there is an inductive argument that then will tell you that, in fact, the expectation of this Melonic invariant at large n only depends on the number of vertices in the graph. not on the structure of the Mellonic graph itself. And of course, it depends on the coupling constants. So when you plug this piece of information into this set of equations, you get that you have a nice set of coupled difference equations. And this can be solved using, let's say, a characteristic polynomial technique. And you can see that there is only one solution that is physical, the one that goes to 1 as the coupling constants go to 0. Okay. And the unique solution is the following. So it is the expectation of the invariant B is just n, because you know the scaling should be linear in n. And it should be a product, or to the power of the exponent here is the number of vertices in B times some function. So this function is the full two-point function evaluated at large n. So what you can see, well, if you know a bit more about tensor models, is that if you were to evaluate this observable, this tensor invariant in a Gaussian, with respect to a Gaussian measure, where the covariance of the Gaussian measure was this function here, this is the evaluation you would get. So this is the result essentially that tells you that at large n, the evaluation of these observables reduces to a Gaussian model. However, the Gaussian universality is a bit subtle in the sense that the covariance itself actually depends on the coupling constants. Okay. And once you have this form, you see that all these Schwinger-Dyson equations actually reduce to a single equation defining for you the large n phase. Okay. And this is essentially the starting point where you can do all the analysis of the Mellonic phase. You can extract this critical exponents. You can look at, for example, the Hausdorffer spectral dimensions. This is essentially the defining equation that gives you everything for that phase. Okay. So as I said, I'm not going to talk about the NLO of 5. Okay, so that's, I have 3 slides. So I said that case study 2 was to show how the Schwinger-Dyson equations can be used to solve for the Green's functions for these tensor invariants, order by order, in N. Okay. And what you would have seen me do if I had done that was that I would have restricted to a set of Mellonic actions. That's where all the interaction terms are just trace invariant observables that are in fact Mellonic graphs. And you would see then that at next to leading order, this arises at this order here. Okay. In the sense that expanding the observables, you see that the two-point function here is the leading order Gaussian. The two-point function that we saw a moment ago evaluated at large n. And then there would be a perturbation term here, the first at 1 on n to the 2. And for higher order Mellonic moments, you would see that you would get Gaussian terms here that are optimally connected, and then some subdominant Gaussian contributions. And then eventually, you see that there is a non-Gaussian contribution contributing at the next to leading order. Okay. So what one finds then is that at this order in the one in an expansion, the Schwinger-Dyson equations for the quadratic and quartic invariants actually form a closed system for these two functions. And it's a linear system. So you can just invert a matrix and get a function that is, you know, pretty horrible to write down, so I didn't. But it has the following behavior, that is interesting for us. And that's that, you know, the two-point invariant, its evaluation is the leading order part, plus this part beginning at next to leading order, and a coefficient that will go to infinity as you tune z to z critical. So what that means then is that you know, there is some hope for a double scaling limit, right? You may hope that even if you balance the scaling in n to infinity with the scaling as z goes to z critical, that you can balance them in such a way that these aren't washed away in that limit, and that you can include more graphs in your theory, in your phase, right? So So you can see this then directly that that to you know the nice thing about the Schwinger-Dyson equations then is that they allow you to directly probe this double scaling limit. So you the idea behind these expansions of the one and n expansion of the tensor model, you could really think of this as zero plus t plus the contributions at this order, right? Whereas what you do is you make an ansatz for the double scaling limit. So you say, well, can I think of another expansion where I'll expand my two-point function about another quantity? And it turns out that the relevant quantity that you should do is the Mullonic phase evaluated at criticality. And then you make an ansatz to see, well, is there some perturbation here that I can do that I can provide that that is non-trivial? And I substituted into one of my Schwinger-Dyson equations. So this is the simplest one that we had that I detailed earlier. And you find that there is that the ansatz of essentially having a non-trivial function KDS forces you to have A d minus 2 on 2 and X as this form. So this is a new coupling constant that you use, the double-scaled coupling constant. And the reason it kills it is because, obviously, when I substitute this object into the Schwinger-Dyson equation, and 1 minute. OK, I have one more slide to this. So when I substitute the quadratic invariant in here, and when I substitute it in here implicitly, remember that in my previous analysis, I could evaluate this in terms of B2 and some fourth order invariant, what one can show is that for the majority of, well, for all except these values of A and X, the term that's the coefficient of 1 on D minus 2 on 2, or the coefficient of 1 on N to the A is non-zero. Well, essentially, it imposes that this function KDS is 0, right? Unless you have A this value and X this definition. And then what it means is that going to the next order, you have an equation that determines KDS non-trivially, and it's quadratic in KDS. And again, you can solve the Schwinger-Dyson equations. And of course, it's very complicated in general. But it has this basic behavior where at that in this limit, resumming the contributions, you have this behavior in the new coupling, the double scaled coupling constant. Okay, so this is exactly again the coupling the form of the critical behavior that you would expect from branch polymers. Of course, it's not. I mean, this is just one exponent, but it seems again so that we get branch polymers in the double scaling limit. Moreover, this series is only resummable below dimension 6. So again, by analyzing the double scaling limit, we see that there is again a critical dimension where we have actually, there is fundamentally different behavior for d less than 6 than for d greater than 6. And it's unknown what the behavior could be at d equals 6. So what I said here then, of course, at the beginning is that at some point you have to give a certain amount of, no smileys, okay, a certain amount of input. And in order to evaluate these, to solve for KDS, you have to make the input that only these tensor invariants are relevant in the double scaling limit. Okay. So I think I should skip this, right? And not go. So I was going to talk about the symmetry algebra, but in any case. So let me give some outlook. So the what we would like to do is improve the manner in which we calculate the scalings of these relevant tensors. So at the moment, we really have to delve into the nitty-gritty of the expansion in order to get the scalings for the relevant observables in these various limits. We would also like to derive multi-scaling limits. So it's for dimensions d less than 6, there is still a possibility to suck yet more contributions into the object, and get higher scalings. And this is interesting from the point of view that Raslan made, that in fact you may have a cascade of phase transitions going from, let's say, the large N, then through the double scaling, through multi-scaling, and going from branch polymers and hopefully eventually having a phase transition out of branch polymers. And the last point referred to the last slide, where I wanted to say that we're looking to analyze this symmetry algebra. So this symmetry algebra, you're going to give out to me here, but this symmetry algebra can be extracted from the Schwinger-Dyson equations by recasting them as operators. And these operators satisfy a Lie algebra that is Virasoro-like, right? But obviously these indices are highly more complicated than just the N and M of the Virasoro, of the Witt algebra. But it is a Lie algebra. And in fact, you can specify subalgebras that determine for you the symmetries of a particular phase. For example, the Melonic phase has been extracted. But so far, it has not been analyzed. And we should do that. Thanks a million.